agreed pretty well as to what constitutes peace. But as we noticed, it is a definitely different literary style. But it is a style which the same man might readily use, because it is the enumerative, statistical sort of style which every one of us does use if we write on economic questions or of matters of that sort. We always find that a certain amount of tabulation, of presentation of material, is the clearest way in which to present. And we notice, however, I call your attention to one instance where something that all the critics had unanimously agreed 10 years ago was peace. Professor Speiser showed on the strength of ancient Babylonian material was perfectly in line with the material from the context of which the critics had rented out to say it was the typical peace style. So today, the newest books, naturally, if they're familiar with Dr. Speiser's writings, no longer give those two particular verses to peace. Now that was H, and I'm not going to give you an I because it would be too easily confused with Roman numeral 1, so we'll skip to J. J, it is generally, J will be J, the document J, is generally spoken of as a unit. And the impression is given that there can be little doubt of its distinctiveness and its unity, semicolon. The document J is generally spoken of as a unit, and the impression is given that there can be little doubt of its distinctiveness and its unity, semicolon. Yet most of the scholars who have discussed the critical theory in detail in recent years now, divide J into two separate documents. You take up almost any of the popular books that are distributed by some of our publishing companies about the story of the Bible. You take up the Sunday school lessons issued by any of our major denominations in America in recent years where they deal with the book of Genesis. You take up any one of the many books that are issued by liberal scholars recently for popular use, which are distributed in this country and translated into many languages and distributed into many areas, and you'll always find J spoken of as a very distinctive thing. Mr. Barr?
Yes, some of us have a tune on this quote here. I would wonder, and there's no doubt, I'm sure
I said the manuscript J is generally spoken of as a unit, and the impression is given that there can be little doubt of its distinctiveness and its unity, semicolon. Yet, most of the scholars who have discussed the critical theory in detail in recent years now divide J into two separate documents. That is something that is not generally realized, but it is a very definite fact. You will find that today, if you go into almost any university in this country, if there's a course in the Bible or in religion, they will talk about the great epic J, as if there's no question of this document, J, as a unit. If you go into a high school in Pennsylvania where they teach the course in the Bible as literature, they will tell about the great epic J. There have probably been 20 books published in the last 10 years of a popular type, by some by Protestants, some by Roman Catholics, some by Jews. Survey of Genesis, A Trip Through the Pentateuch, The Early Days of the Bible, titles like that. And they all tell about the document J, the earliest book of Hebrew history, a book which gives you the rather primitive ideas of the early Hebrews. Some will even imagine stories about a hermit who collected the records, the ideas of different early people, and put them together, formed them into this great epic J. J is taught as a definite, distinct unit, as it was held by the Wellhausen theory. But if you take the books written by men who claim to be experts in the study of the Old Testament, men who follow the critical theory and who are writing detailed books discussing the problems in detail, you will find that practically every one of them will recognize that what is called the doctrine of J, they will say, has in turn to be divided into two main sources. Now, some have called these J1 and J2. Professor Pfeiffer of Harvard University, about 25 years ago, published an introduction to the Old Testament, which later appeared in a second edition. And Professor Pfeiffer, in that book, advanced the theory that there was another document called S, which was made up entirely of material that other scholars thought was part of J. All of the early narratives of Genesis that the critics ordinarily put in J, he called part of S. The S stands for Seir. It was an Edomite document. It came from Mount Seir. And it, according to him, was not united with the rest of the Pentateuch until after all the other documents were put together. Whereas, according to the standard critical theory, the J document is the very first one to which the others were gradually added. Well, he would hold that also about what was left of J, but he takes out of it this large part, which he calls S. I know of no scholar who has followed Pfeiffer in this S theory. Yes? No, he would find some S anywhere in the Pentateuch. But I noted particularly that these distinctive features of J, which we find in the early parts of Genesis, he gives to S. Now, even before Pfeiffer wrote that, Professor Eisfeld of the University of Halle in Germany, Eisfeld, E-I-S-S-F-E-L-D-T, E-I-S-S-F-E-L-D-T. Professor Eisfeld has published a large introduction to the Old Testament, which has gone through several editions in German, and one of them was translated into English about 5 years ago, and reviewers said it probably would replace Pfeiffer and the previous driver as the leading introduction to the Old Testament in the English language. Now, Professor Eisfeld, as far back as 1926, published in German a book on the composition of the Hexateuch, in which he took the whole of the Pentateuch in German and he arranged it in columns so that to show what, according to him, was in each of the documents. But he did not merely have columns for J, E, and P. Of course, D is largely Deuteronomy. But he also had a column which he called L. And L to Eisfeld stands for the lay document as opposed to the priestly document. And a large part of the J document he put in L. And Eisfeld in this volume in published in 1926 and reprinted in 1966. In this volume, he would pick out two or three words out of a verse that belonged to the L document. And then maybe the next five would belong to the E document. And then the next verse would start with a little from the J document. He divided it word for word up into these different documents, but he included his lay document, his L document. And now a German scholar today named Forer, F-O-H-R-E-R, is perhaps the latest professor in Germany to issue a series of editions of an introduction to the Old Testament. And Forer, the latest edition of his introduction to the Old Testament, which came out just 3 years ago, within 1 year was translated into English, much quicker than any of the others had been. And it is being widely distributed in universities in America today. And in Forer's introduction, he takes a part of the J document and puts it in what he calls the N document, N standing for the nomadic document, the document written by nomads in the desert, as compared with the rest of J, which, according to him, was written by people in Canaan itself. And so here you have each of these men having a new terminology for a large section out of the J document, which he advances with great dogmatism and tells you exactly which verses belong in it. Now, a man like Professor Albright of Johns Hopkins University, a great scholar in the Near Eastern field, who has done much study in the Old Testament but has not specialized in higher Christian like these other men, simply adopts the Wellhausen theory as far as the division is concerned. And Professor Albright, about 8 or 10 years ago, said that of the existence of the great documents J, E, D, and P, there can be no doubt is, and we should not be misled by these aberrations, such as finding an S document or an L document and so on. That's the way he tries to brush these aside. But the men who are working directly in the Pentateuchal study from the higher critical viewpoint do not see the great unity of J, which is one of the foundations of the whole critical theory. And to my notion, this is a strong argument against the whole idea that it can be divided according to style in this way. Now, let's say Roman numeral K, or capital K, yes? In nomadic, yes. It's parts of J, parts of J. All three of these were parts of J. I was dealing there, now there's a book published in America not so long ago that discusses simply the document P and divides it into about 8 original sources from which it was taken. But I'm speaking particularly of J because this is a very foundational thing in the Wellhausen theory, the unity of J, the integrity of this particular document. Yes? The same arguments from style on which you would find differences between J and E would find differences within J. See, what I'm trying to show is that the approach is not one which is valid. That the evidence from style on which they claim to divide into J, E, and P can just as well divide each of them into many subdivisions. And what they hold to most strongly as one of the central features, the J document, these three men, at least among the very leading scholars in that area, feel must in turn be divided into subdivisions. Now K, capital K. Capital K, actually distinction of various styles within a document actually is extremely difficult. Distinction of various styles within a document actually is extremely difficult. There was about 150 years ago, no, I guess not quite that much, about 100 years ago, there was a German scholar named Scherer, S-C-H-E-R-E-R, who wrote a series of articles which he called Goethe-Studien, that studies in the writings of Goethe. You know the great German poet Goethe, probably the greatest poet Germany ever produced and generally considered as one of the world's greatest poets. Goethe's great work was his book Faust. And the Faust legend is a legend which was known all through the Middle Ages. There's a French opera based on it, who knows Faust. There was an English play by Christopher Marlowe written just before Shakespeare's time on Faust. But Goethe wrote a great work, Faust, which is his masterpiece, and he spent a great part of his life working on it. Well, Scherer wrote some studies of Goethe in which he took his the prologue to Faust, and he went through it, noticing the difference in style from the features distinctive of Goethe's youth when he had the enthusiasm and the vigor and the confidence of youth and the phrases which showed the disillusion and discouragement of old age. So he tried to show which parts of it represented Goethe's early style and which parts represented his later style. For it was the whole of Faust was published near the end of Goethe's life. He had a very long life. And at the end of his life, when this was published, it was recognized as a very great masterpiece, but it was well known that he had worked on it off and on most of his life and had begun working on it as a young man. And so these studies of Scherer apply the higher critical stylistic methods to show the difference between the style of the young Goethe and the style of the old Goethe. And then someone came across, a woman was going through some old trunks, and she found there that her grandmother had been a lady-in-waiting at the court of Weimar in Germany, where Goethe spent most of his life. He had come there when he was a comparatively young man, and her grandmother had been a lady in waiting there at the court. And this person found that the grandmother had heard Goethe read parts of Faust, the parts he'd already written then, at a gathering of friends there, and she had asked him to let her borrow the manuscript for a few days and copy parts of it, and he had let her do it. And so here was something written when Goethe was perhaps 40 years before the end of his life. 40 or 50 years before the end of his life, here was copied out portions of Goethe. They were then published when they were rediscovered and called the Urfaust, the original, the early Faust. And in this, it was found that the prologue was almost identical with the final form. That is to say, there's no question Goethe worked over many parts of it, changing and improving. But this particular section of it, which Shearer believed he could find the evidences of the difference between Goethe's early style and his later style, was practically all written when he was a very young man. And some of the expressions which seem to show the disillusionment and discouragement of Goethe's old age were simply his expression of Faust's feeling of those things, and were written when he was quite young.
I think that is a very good instance of the difficulty of distinguishing style in a document. There's a book called Theory of Literature, published in 1942, new edition in 1956, by Rennie Wellick, professor of literature in Yale University. And in this book, The Theory of Literature, he mentions the fact that two writers in the Elizabethan age in England, named Beaumont and Fletcher, collaborate in writing plays and writing poems, but that each of them also wrote works by himself, which we have. And so in this case, we have individual works by Beaumont and by Fletcher, which we can study to see their style, and then we have works that they wrote in collaboration. And he says that even in the case of Beaumont and Fletcher, in which we have this advantage of having separate works by them, the division between their shares cannot be established beyond controversy. And one work of the Elizabethan age, The Revenger's Tragedy, has been assigned by different scholars to Webster, Tunier, Middleton, and Marston, alternatively or in various combinations. Thus, it's simply an illustration which Wellick gives of the difficulty of distinguishing different literary styles. There is a great Hindu epic called the Mahabharata. Yes? W-E-L-L-E-K. The last one I mentioned? The last I mentioned was the Revenger's Tragedy. The Revenger's Tragedy. There's a great Hindu epic called the Mahabharata. Now, the Mahabharata is a very extensive work which has a story of certain wars between different groups. There's quite a definite story running through it, but then there are long mythical accounts and moralistic discussions. And it is generally believed that there was a short writing at a very early time in India, the Mahabharata, and then these mythical and moralistic sections were added to it. But at about 1900, Professor Hopkins of Yale, trying to determine from it exactly what was the original narrative core written many centuries before the time of Christ, and then what were the different additions in a different style made later on to enlarge it to its present tremendous length. And he came to the conclusion that it was impossible to determine. And in 1962, The Stanford University Press published a book by Charles Drechmeyer on kingship and community in early India, in which Drechmeyer made this statement. He said, Hopkins many years ago concluded that the original narrative core of the epic is impossible to isolate from the later mythical and moralistic accretion, and few present-day students of the Mahabharata would question this judgment. Now, these instances I have given of writings which are generally believed to be composite writings, but on which it is today recognized that it is practically impossible to determine what parts come from one period, what from another, what from one author, what from another. Now, capital L, conclusion regarding the four arguments for partition. Conclusion regarding the four arguments for partition. We have these arguments for partition and the arguments for development. And it is the coming together of these two different streams which produced the Wellhausen theory, which became so well established and is so well established in the world of education today. We've been looking at the arguments for partition. We've examined each of the four arguments. We have seen that no one of these four arguments really stands up as a safe method of dividing the Pentateuch into doctrines. We have seen the weaknesses of them. No one of them is sufficient, and they altogether are not sufficient to prove the case for dividing the Pentateuch up into documents, as is taught to be established fact in just about every theological seminary in the world over 50 years old, and in practically every university in the world where anything is today taught about the Bible. Now we want to look at the other area, the theories of development. But before we do that, I want to look just a little further at this matter of partition in general. And so I will make a Roman numeral 10. Roman numeral 10, theories of partition have now largely disappeared from general literary study. Theories of partition have now largely disappeared from general literary study. Now, under that, I would like to call your attention as capital A to two underlying assumptions of theories of partition. Two underlying assumptions of theories of partition. These underlying assumptions are, first, that most ancient works are composite, formed by combining sections from various authors. That's the first of the assumptions, that most ancient or medieval works are composite, formed by putting together sections from different authors. And second, that it is possible to determine in a composite work what were the different sections. Now you notice I say that the assumption is that most ancient medieval writings were formed in this way. We do not deny, of course, that some works have been formed in this way. There is no question of that. There is a large work in the library in about 25 large volumes called The Historian's History of the World in our library. This is a work which a man named Williams put together by taking the great historical writers and copying sections from them, and then making very brief sections to combine them. And so, except for the brief sections which he's put in, all of it is taken from various writers. And he has a little mark, a little mark A at the beginning of a paragraph means this begins a section. He inserted simply to combine sections. Otherwise, you'll have small B, C, D, or whatever it is, and in the back he'll tell you what book it is taken from. It is a great composite work, including writings of many different writers, but they are indicated in it. It is definitely a composite work. Now, there's most presidential addresses that have been given in America in the last 50 years have been written by various men working over them. One works over the part, one suggests a part, another suggests a part, someone else combines them. They are composite works. Many composite works have been written at different times. I mentioned Beaumont and Fletcher, how they wrote plays together. There are many such composite writings of people who have collaborated. But I don't know whether any really great work has ever been written in this way. And certainly, while there are composite works, by no means all the writings have been done in this way. Now, the assumption about two centuries ago was that practically everything was written in this way. And so these theories were applied to all sorts of documents. And, of course, then the higher criticism has the further assumption that we can separate them. And we notice in the case of Beaumont and Fletcher and in the case of the Mahabharata how very difficult it is to do that when you have a composite work. I think the great difficulty of doing it is a strong argument against the validity of the higher criticism. We are, of course, more interested in the question of whether it is, after all, a composite work. Now, it's altogether possible. The Book of Psalms certainly is, to some extent, a composite work. There are people who speak of it all as the Psalms of David. We know that the name of David was given to the book very early, and yet one of them is called a Psalm of Moses. Various others are attributed to various writers. David wrote more of them than anyone else, so it's not at all improper to call the whole book the Psalms of David, but many of them are by different writers. But the probabilities are that just about every one of the Psalms was written as a unit, each individual psalm, even though in the book we have the writings of various men. When it comes to the books of Kings and of Chronicles, no one person lived during the whole period. And it is altogether probable that whoever wrote the Book of Kings or the Book of Chronicles had documents before him, written at the time of these various kings, extending over some centuries. And he may have copied out some sections rather extensively, and in others he may have made a good many changes. That would be, in a way, then, a composite work. But theory as held about two centuries ago and up until comparatively recently was that most ancient and medieval writings were composite, and scholars devoted a great deal of time and attention to endeavoring to divide them up and to know which parts came from each general writer. Now, a tremendous change has taken place, and the biblical scholars are quite unaware of the change. I was unaware of it until within the last 5 years. Most of the biblical scholars don't know a great deal about general literature. And you pick up most any book presenting the higher criticism today, and they will say, in studying the Bible, we must apply the same literary principles that we would apply in studying any other book. And they don't realize that the literary principles they are applying are principles which were applied to all other books a century ago, but which are almost never, or I better not quite that strong, which are very rarely applied today to other works than the Bible. 20 years ago, when I discussed the introduction to the Pentateuch, I used to make the statement, which is probably made today in most classes in religious schools where they deal with the higher criticism at all, to say, well, there's nothing wrong with higher criticism. It's better perhaps to talk about destructive criticism, because higher criticism simply is the attempt to determine authorship and origin
And it's anybody that is interested in such questions is per se a higher critic. Well, that was true a century ago. It probably was true 50 years ago. It is not true today. I got a hold of about 30 of the latest books on literary criticism. And in every one of them, I looked up higher criticism in the index. And I found that in most of them, the phrase higher criticism did not even occur. It is a phrase which has dropped out of use in ordinary literary study today. Now, when Eichhorn wrote his introduction to the Old Testament, he's the first one who used the term in relation to the Pentateuch. He said that to students of literature, the term higher criticism is nothing new. They are all thoroughly familiar with it. Higher criticism was recognized as a definite approach to study. Today, the term has disappeared, and to a very great extent, the thing for which the term stood has disappeared. There's a book written by a professor in Vermont, a man who is very anti-Christian. He wrote a long book on anti-Christian movements of the last century, and then in his next long book, he had a very sad introduction in which he bemoaned the fact that though his previous book had been widely circulated, people were still building churches, and religion was still a force in American life. But in this book, in which he's a professor of literature, and in this book, he speaks of the almost miraculous way in which the original sources of the Pentateuch have been worked out, and in which, he says, the original sections of Homer's Iliad and Odyssey have been worked out. He recognized that in his area of literature, this was simply not being done. It is almost miraculous the way it has been successfully done, according to him, in areas which are not his field of study, and which he simply takes these statements over from others. It is comparatively recently that it has, to a great extent, not entirely, disappeared from general study, this method of a source study. And it is not something that has been generally recognized. The average student of literature today is unfamiliar with this approach of finding sources. He would simply not know much about it. Whereas the average student of literature 60 years ago, that's what he was interested in trying to do. But the change came rather gradually, but it is quite pervasive. A few writers probably had a great deal to do in bringing about the change. Now, the case which has perhaps received most attention in connection with the changed attitude is the case of the writings of Homer. As you know, Homer was the great Greek. They are the two great Greek writings of a very, very early period, among the three or four earliest writings from ancient Greece that are in existence. Two of them are the long poems of the Iliad and the Odyssey. And the Iliad and the Odyssey, until about two centuries ago, were always considered to be the work of a man named Homer. But in ancient Greece, there were various theories as to where Homer was born. Quite a large number of theories. There was a theory that he was a blind poet who went about from place to place reciting his poems. Actually, there was very little known about this man Homer. Although in the time of the great Greek, the height of Greek civilization, the poems of Homer were studied and many commentaries written on them, and they were considered as the greatest flower of Greek genius. But very little was known about Homer. But probably nobody questioned his existence until about 200 years ago. And then about 200 years ago, the higher critical movement, which was then beginning to become strong in literary circles, was applied to Homer, and Professor Wolf in Germany advanced his theories of the Homer having been, and there not having been any man Homer, but there having been different poems written by different people which gradually came together as these wandering minstrels sang their song and gradually changed them. They were combined, and thus the Iliad and the Odyssey came into existence. Goethe was very much fascinated by these theories of Wolf's. I believe I mentioned once, in fact, how Goethe asked Wolf's daughter to hide him behind a curtain in the lecture room, so that when Wolf lectured on Homer, he wouldn't be embarrassed by having the great famous poet Goethe in the room. But yet, Goethe would be able to hear what he was saying. They didn't have any tape recorders in those days, so he couldn't have it made so he could listen to it later. But Goethe was very fascinated at this early time in his life by these theories. But later, as Goethe studied the works of Homer more and more, Goethe came to the conclusion that there was a great genius at work in Homer's writing, a marvelous unity to them, such an ability that could not possibly have come into existence by a hit-and-miss process such as Wolf had. And so before the end of Goethe's life, and I think it was around 1830 when he died, before the end of his life, he published a retraction in which he declared that he no longer held to the theory of the disintegration of Homer into different writers. But Homer, at that time, probably these theories were hardly known in England. Probably everyone in England, till about 1850, believed in the unity of Homer. But then it was about 1850 and the next few years that these theories began to be promulgated in England. And they spread to such an extent that probably by 1900 there was probably no prominent person in the world who would maintain the unity of the Iliad or the Odyssey as unified works. Now, as you say, they're written by Homer. We know practically nothing about Homer. We don't know where he was born, anything about his life. Homer can be to us just a name. That is to say, that there was a genius, a man of great ability, who wrote these two poems, or at least two men, at most two men, that is to say, that each, whether they're written by the same man or might be written by different men, that each of them is a great unified work, is something that hardly any scholar believed in 1900. But in recent years, more and more books have been written to prove the unity of the Homeric writers, at least to prove that each one of them is a great unified work. Very few are much concerned with whether the two are by the same man or not. Some think the Odyssey was written by a woman. All kinds of theories have been advanced about it. Some think they both were written by the same person, some by different. But in general, the unity of Homer is today more widely held than any of the very detailed theories that were worked out and were so widespread at the beginning of the present century. Now, I don't suppose there's any scholar who works in Homer today who would say that every word of Homer is as it came from the mouth of the original minstrel. It was passed on by word of mouth for a time before it was written down. I was interested to read a book by a professor in Harvard in which he said, how did it come that the Homeric works were written down? Well, he said, we find that the J document was written down at a little before the time when we have our earliest evidence of Homer being in written form. So probably it was from knowledge of the J document that the idea came to write the Iliad down. Of course, that's purely conjectural. He went to the professor of Old Testament in Harvard, I suppose to Professor Pfeiffer, and asked him about that and used that as his basis for his theory regarding Homer. Today, students of Homer are divided into two groups. The one is called the Unitarians, those who believe in the unity of the work. The others, they would not necessarily hold it was all original, but that in the main case, and there are a few who still hold to divisive theories, but the great divisive theories which were so widely accepted are in almost all their details given up today as far as Homer is concerned. I was very interested in picking up a book by Professor Helen Gardner of Oxford, written in 1859, called The Business of criticism. In this book, Professor Gardner has quite a little to say about the change which he has observed in relation to the attitude toward various works of literature. On page 97, she makes some rather strong statements. She says there, in field after field, theories of composite authorship, earlier versions, different strata, have been discarded. The kind of analysis which was once thought to be the particular duty of literary criticism is now markedly out of fashion. The assumption today is more and more in favor of single authorship unless there is clear external evidence to the contrary, and of taking works as they stand and not postulating earlier versions to account for inconsistencies. Even were the inconsistencies in the work as published, even where the inconsistencies in the work as published are as glaring as they are in the Faerie Queene, most people would agree with Professor C.S. Lewis that it is quite impossible to reconstruct historically the phases in Spencer's invention of which particular inconsistencies are, so to speak, the fossils. He says the importance of the single plan and treatment of the new Oxford History of English Literature now in progress, as compared with that of the old Cambridge history, schools of influence, are out of fashion. Old disintegrating theories which assume that Shakespeare spent much of his time revising other men's plays, and later attempts to show him as almost continuously engaged in revising his own. Theories of Beowulf being based on heroic ladies, and later theories of a pre-Christian Beowulf, were all in the air, or at least being debated 30 years ago, although they were then being increasingly challenged. The modern undergraduate is not troubled by these discussions. Occam's razor has been applied to the critical postulates beloved by 19th century scholars. The modern scholar or critic concentrates in the first place on making what he can of his text as it has come down to him. There has been a strong reaction against the study of even extant and known sources, much more against the discussion of hypothetical ones. I was much interested when I came across the strong statements by Professor Gardner in her book. Yes?
You mentioned that in 1959.
This is
1959,
yes. Oh, 1959. Thank you very much. I was much interested when I came across these statements, strong statements by Professor Gardner. I copied out some of them, and I sent them to the professors of literature in four or five of our leading universities. And I asked them, I said, I noticed Professor Gardner said this in her book. Would you think this was a fair representation of the attitude of scholarship today towards the study of sources? And I got some very interesting answers. And one letter from a professor in Yale University said, there are those who do not think very much of Professor Gardner's little book, but personally I like it very much. And then he went on to give a discussion of the way in which the scholars of a few years ago would divide Shakespeare up among different authors. And he said, just read, and he named about 10 or 12 authors of about 40 years ago. And then he said, compare them with, and he named 10 or 12 Shakespearean critics of today. And he said, it's easy to see the great difference in general approach that has taken place. Although he did say in his letter, he said, this is a difficult subject to discuss in print. He said it would be much more pleasant to discuss it over a cup of coffee. But he wrote me a long letter giving his general observations on that. And I did not get a single letter from anyone who disagreed with the general viewpoints that Professor Gardner had expressed. In the University of London, there have been a number of scholars who have taken up the study of medieval writing and have examined the various theories that have been taken of dividing them up into all these different documents, and then have shown the absurdity of many of these theories. One of these is R.W. Chambers. And R.W. Chambers, speaking of the Beowulf, showed how this great in early Anglo-Saxon epic, which is known only in one manuscript, which was found somewhere in England a century or two ago. And formerly, scholars said this work is originally a pagan work, which had Christian elements added to it later. He says most scholars have long ago abandoned the attempt and have come to agree that the Christian elements are almost without exception so deeply ingrained in the very fabric of the poem that they cannot be explained away as the work of a reviser or later interpreter. Later on in his book, speaking of this idea of the composite works of some of our great productions having been composite works, Chambers said, half a dozen motorbikes cannot be combined to make a Rolls-Royce car, which I thought was an interesting illustration. A great literary work would seem to require a great author. And certainly one of our great literary works is that work which is called The Penitent. That work which the holders of the fragmentary theory divided up into all sorts of little tiny sections. And then there came the great reaction against it by Abel and others, in which they pointed out the tremendous unity of it and the great unity of purpose and of organization in it. Today, the higher critics hold a field among scholarly students of the Bible, and they have passed on the theories to all the rest of the Old Testament and to most of the New Testament, and particularly to the Gospels. But in other areas of study, and I have examined rather minutely perhaps 20 or 30 of these works, which were divided up so much during the period up to it in the last 30 or 40 years, and have noticed how most of the leading scholars today have just about completely given up this approach to literature. So when you read a book that says we must use literary principles in approaching the Bible, just as we would in any other literary work, ask the question, does the author of this book on the Bible really know anything about what the principles are that are being used today in approaching literary works? We continue there tomorrow.